Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics, with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Christian has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore on
a big step. Oh!
What a lead, Toledo Artis. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan, open, Chicago with the lead!
All right, welcome to another edition of the Over and Back NBA podcast. I'm Rich Krage alongside Jason Mann. Jason, you're a little under the weather, so I'm going to handle the intro for this guy, but this is a very special edition. You're probably wondering why we're back on so quickly after, you know, sort of stating we're going to do it once every few weeks. Well, it's because of very important news happening. We sort of broke it in our preview podcast, and that was the retirement, or not the retirement, well, what is likely the impending retirement of Steve Nash. Obviously, he's out for the year now. Looks like it'll probably be the end for Steve Nash. If he comes back, we're all going to look like idiots, but either way, we're going to go with it anyway. We talked a little bit about Steve Nash, but I don't think we did it our proper due. I mean, we needed to give him the whole thing, the whole spiel, the over and back treatment, as I say. But Jason, before we get into that, how are you doing?
I'm great, man. Thanks for taking care of the intro. I appreciate that. I have my sexy voice tonight, which is appropriate.
You're going to sound like, between you and I, it's going to be hard to tell the difference.
Yeah. So, appropriate for Steve Nash, who, I don't know, was Steve Nash the sexiest player in NBA history?
I mean, he got a Spice Girl, so that's pretty good.
That's pretty good, yeah. I don't know. Some of the haircuts maybe were, didn't help him out, but... But yeah, I'm excited to talk, and we got some of the Podium Game family here joining us.
We do. It's a roundtable here. So what we're going to do is we're going to do a little roundtable session, and then get into sort of what we normally do, our career path stuff. But let's introduce our special guests here. We have Jordan White and Brian Giverman, both of the Podium Game and the Hardwood Paroxysm family. Brian, he writes for the Bright Side of the Sun as well, SB Nation Phoenix Suns block. And Jordan, you know Jordan. For God's sake, if you're on the Podium Game, you know Jordan, right? Come on.
How you guys doing?
How you doing, guys? Doing good. Thanks, guys, for coming on and talking with us about Steve Nash. I guess first, we'll just talk a little bit maybe about like our favorite Steve Nash memories. Jordan, do you want to go first?
Yeah, actually, Steve Nash was actually the one who like got me into NBA basketball in the first place. I remember I picked up an ESPN, the magazine, with Nash on the cover. He was laying on a bunch of basketballs, and the title was something like "Fun is Back in the NBA" or something like that. And so I just read all about 7 seconds or less, and so I was like, okay, well, I guess I should, check this out. And as soon as I saw the first game of like those Phoenix Suns, I was hooked. It's funny because with a lot of players. And most players, like, they play within limitations because there are limitations of the game. There are only so many ways you can make shots, so many dunks you can do, et cetera, et cetera. But Nash always kind of seemed to ignore that and make passes that didn't make sense or kind of defied logic, but at the same time always hit their mark. No one else, like, it's Nash's a player you should never, ever want. You should want to emulate him, but you should never try to. Because more than likely your pass is going to be a turnover. With Nash, it's just he had that uncanny ability to see impossible angles and make the pass from just like weird contorts of his body. And he was absolutely amazing to watch.
And how about you, Brian?
I'll be honest. When Nash won those two MVPs, I was one of the people who was like, I don't know if he really deserves it. The one year I kind of thought Kobe should have won when he carried that Smush Parker team to the playoffs. And then as the Suns started to get worse, and after 10-11 when they lost to Mari, and then they went 40-42 but had a chance to make the playoffs that last month of the season. I think they were like four games over going into the final – into the final month. And then the strike shortened year, they went 33-33 and basically played a play-in game with the Utah Jazz for a playoff spot, the second to last game of the season is when I really truly gained an appreciation of how good he was, because those teams really lacked a lot of talent and he put them on his back and kept them respectable. And it was really amazing to see.
What about you, Rich?
Yeah, for me, it sort of works in two ways. Similar to a lot of guys and similar to Jordan, I maybe have jumped in a little bit earlier I was a huge big basketball fan, growing up in Chicago, but it wasn't really an appreciation of the game. And I mentioned this in our preview that it really was that Dallas Mavericks team, the Steve Nash and Dirk, that really turned me back into like a real fan is what I would say, in 98. I'm just kind of cheering on because, the Bulls are good and all that sort of stuff. And I'm pretty young as well, but I started getting old enough and I started playing the game a lot more. And I saw Nash and I saw Dirk, and it was just like, I mean, this was just, especially when you sort of, as Jordan said, it was just, what he did was just, it was just amazing stuff. It was high octane basketball. It was crazy. It was, I talked about on the preview as well, is that, I would stay up late on school nights watching the Dallas Mavericks because I couldn't fall asleep because they were going to score 120 points or whatever. So it was that team really that was a big part of mine. I'm still a Dallas Mavericks fan to this day. I'm still a Dirk fan to this day. And Nash played a huge part in that as well. Then he goes to Phoenix, and then it's just sort of this, you just see a changing of the game and just a whole different attitude to the game, a whole different approach to the game. And just so many memories for me of being in high school, being in college and all that stuff. And those late Thursday TNT Western Conference games. And a lot of them had Nash in them, and you just never knew what to expect. It was just always high octane. It was always, go, go, go. And there was success involved in it too. And it was always this sort of fun thing of, okay, look, can this sort of game be successful? And then people saying, well, you have to slow down come playoff time. And then, them getting a few games away from the finals and stuff. And it was always kind of a fun thing. And then obviously 7 Seconds or Less, we talked about it, last week as well. It was one of my favorite basketball books ever. And one that I read and reread still to this day. And just an amazing, yeah. I mean, there's so many memories. It's hard to pick out just one, just an overall idea of me and my true sort of growing up as a basketball fan. A lot of it was watching Steve Nash.
Yeah. And for me, I kind of think of like the 2005-06 season, the second season with him in Phoenix, and they lost Amari for basically the entire season, but they were still able to be 54-28. They made the Western Conference Finals, and basically they had, they still had Nash and they had Marion, but they lost Joe Johnson, but they added Boris Diaw, who did nothing in Atlanta, who I watched the year before in the 2004-2005 Hawks. I always like to mention do absolutely nothing. And, they had Roger Bell, James Jones, Kurt Thomas, Tim Thomas, some good players and some decent role players. But taking that team to 50, to that record and then making it that far. They even fell behind 3-1 to the Lakers in the first round, but rallied. I mean, they just had some incredible games that season. And it was kind of the same for me where, you saw like, hey, they're going to be the late game on TNT and you're just really excited to see them because, they're just so fun to watch and so terrific. And I just think that year was really, the second MVP year, which even though like on an individual statistical level, maybe didn't really necessarily merit that MVP, but just being able to keep that team in such a strong position, even though they had lost so much, I think really was just pretty incredible. So, maybe talking a little bit about like Nash's influence on the NBA and what made him special. What are kind of your guys's thoughts on that? Brian, maybe you can go first this time.
As I think a lot of people probably agree with this. I mean, their style of basketball that happened when him and D'Antoni came together was the perfect match. And it's the most fun style of basketball to watch play. Like, defense is really important, and it's a very big part of how to construct the team. But the way those Suns teams played was just beautiful to see on a night-in and night-out basis. And those matchups, when you had the Mavs, the Suns, the Kings were kind of at the very end there. It kind of transitioned from the Kings to the Suns as the fun team to watch. Those Western Conference times were some of my most fun I've had watching basketball.
Jordan?
A few things. It was the probe dribble, most of all. I mean, where he'd go from one side, usually like just a little bit beyond the elbow, go behind the basket, looking for any avenue, any angle to pass, and then pop right back out on the other side. Because he inverted the entire field, basically, or the entire court, his vision. And so he either have someone open on the wing, because like you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to go under the basket and keep your dribble alive. No one expects you to keep your dribble alive there. So you either have an open shooter somewhere, or if they finally learn how to if the defense would cover the shooters, then he could just kind of turn around real quick and plop that easy jumper. And then I think he's maybe the most underappreciated shooter in league history because he was a reluctant shooter. Like he liked getting guys involved more, but he's just such a prolific shooter. His percentages were absolutely incredible. So those are the two things that really stand out for me. I mean, I know the shooting thing isn't necessarily an impact, but it's something I think that's not talked about enough. And then the probe dribble. I mean, you talk to any player. I asked Dragic about this last year because I noticed he was doing it. I was like, did you learn that from Nash? He's like, yeah, of course. Steve taught it to me, and, you know, it's one of my favorite things to do. So, like, and you see other players. Mike Conley does it. Chris Paul does it. Tony Parker does it. There's so many players that use that probe dribble now.
Can I add some to his shooting thing? One of the most underappreciated parts of Nash within that realm is how incredible he was finishing close to the basket, someone his size, how he could move his body and shoot with both hands, and the floaters from even a little bit farther out probably doesn't get talked about enough as part of how his game was able to work.
One of the most like enduring memories for me with Nash, it was in, I don't know, it was one of their playoff series with the Mavericks. And again, Nash did that probe thing, and he came out just to like maybe the block, and Dirk's defending him, and Dirk kind of thinks that he's going to pass, but instead he doesn't. He flips the ball over like his head. He's still facing away from the basket, but he flips it behind his back, and it goes in for layup, like as if that was like exactly what he planned to do. And it was as easy to him as breathing, but anybody else who had tried to attempt that, it would have just been stupid.
What about you, Rich?
For me, there's a few things that really, I mean, you look at the pace of the game, and obviously the Suns and D'Antoni, they weren't the first guys to have, you know, a very high pace, you know, that we saw obviously with the Lakers, you know, the decade prior were, you know, a very quick paced team. The Bulls, even in the early 90s, were quick paced. But I think more than anything, the Suns and a little bit of Dallas and a little bit, you know, of you know, Brian mentioned the Kings as well, of a team that, you had some teams that were playing at a quicker pace, and they were the one that really truly had prolonged success, that it was sort of starting to scare the NBA, and maybe not scare the NBA in general, but scared sort of the narrative of you need to slow down to win in the playoffs, because there was the times when the Suns were winning even in the playoffs and they were getting deep playoff runs, and there were certain things that sort of happened. And of that, more than anything, and you can look at sort of the pace increase in the NBA as, you know, what was happening before the Suns really had their success and what happened afterwards. It might be, I don't want to attribute all of it to them, but I think there is something significant in there of them sort of getting us out of what I would consider the dark ages, the early, you know, 2000s where it was, you know, defense wins championships, slow it down. I mean, we had the Spurs, the Pistons, those sort of teams that were very slow, very methodical, and the Suns come out here and they just explode the whole thing. And now we're seeing that now. It's a lot of winning teams. That's how they play. I mean, they play that way. And I don't know. I'm not going to necessarily attribute that to the Suns, but I think in a way, though, it helped sort of get the NBA out of those dark ages. And you saw this, and you saw a fun, exciting, and also successful brand of basketball coming out of that very quick pace.
Yeah, there was a good Eric Kareen at the National Post had a good saying that Nash's first year in Phoenix, the Suns used an average of 9.86 possessions of the per game, which was the quickest pace in the league. And then last season, the Spurs used an average of 97.1 possessions, which was, I believe, 12th in the league. So they're playing almost as fast as the Suns did, you know, in 2004-05, but are now, you know, close to the middle of the pack of the league. I think that's just, you know, demonstrating what you're talking about with just, you know, the pace getting quicker. And I definitely think the Spurs, I mean, even Popovich has talked about, you know, using some of the principles from the 7 seconds or less Suns, and obviously Nash, you know, being the most important player in that. And I think the other thing about Nash, and you guys kind of definitely touched on it, but I just think just watching him, the way he's able to put things through tight spaces, whether it's those just those, you know, precision passes, or whether it's, you know, being able to kind of dribble around, circle around, and just, you know, get like a quick scoop or layup in, you know, that kind of thing. Just being able to make something out of just a very, very, very tiny hole is just, you know, really impressive. And just to be able to do that commonly, and just, you know, to do a, like a behind the back pass because it's the ruthlessly efficient thing to do, as opposed to being like a show off thing to do, is just, you know, made him special and neat. You know, particularly you, Brian, I know obviously being in Phoenix for a long time, but any of you guys this applies to, are there any, you know, personal interactions with Nash or anything, you know, kind of along those lines, anything interesting that you can share?
You know, I don't have anything specific because I wasn't in the locker room on a regular basis like a beat writer, but he was always insightful and he was always a good person to go to for a quote. He was honest. He was open about things with the team. You could talk to him about anything you wanted. And he was always very good in dealing with the media. He was a very easy person to deal with, never had an issue whatsoever.
All right. So, you know, obviously he and Dirk emerged as superstars in Dallas, and they had made a run to the Western Conference Finals in 03. Do we think that team sort of now gets overlooked because of Nash's success in Phoenix? Jordan, do you want to answer first?
I think so. I think they get a little bit overlooked, but I think it was also – the reason they get overlooked is also because it wasn't necessarily a sustained thing. I mean, you talked about that was their emergence, but then – it kind of took the both of them to go their separate ways, or at least, you know, Dirk staying and Nash going to Phoenix, for them to really have like a sustained greatness. And I think they could have done that in Dallas, but it just so happens that they didn't. But yeah, that team does get, it doesn't get talked about as much as it should, but also because I think there's not as much else around it. Like Don Nelson always played fast. That was always his style. Whereas, you know, 7 seconds or less, that was, you don't have that catchy name to it, and D'Antoni and all that. There was a lot more just to it there.
Yeah, they had a book written about them too. That
right, helped. Yeah, that helps. That helps a lot. I also think one other reason it gets overlooked is because Nash's hair was just. I think there's like the less said about it, the better, and so that kind of cuts in there. You're like, maybe we shouldn't go there.
Yeah, the hair, the long stringy hair in the early Phoenix years wasn't great either, though.
At least it wasn't bleached.
Yeah, that's true. Well, what's funny about that team, though, and I think it's Jordan's point a little bit. I think it's because that next year they so imploded, and that was the year where, you know, they got Jameson, they got Walker, and then that team went from – it just went manic, too. Like, they had the worst – like, I think – I don't know if they were the worst defense, but I know they went to, like – from that the year where you're talking about, where they went to the Western Conference Finals, I think they were a top 10, you know, obviously a top 10 offense, and I believe a top 10 defense. And then the next year they were number one offense, but like a bottom three defense or something. And the team was just a train wreck. And I think that really hurts it a little bit, is because it, as Jordan said, it wasn't a prolonged thing. It was sort of, it felt like a one lucky year blip. And then, yeah, what didn't help is that when they both went their separate ways, there was both a lot more tremendous, you know, individual and team level success. So we sort of just assumed that was just kind of a blip. And yeah, they got lucky or something like that, which I don't know if it's necessarily fair, but I think it sort of, that's how the narrative kind of plays out.
And Dallas winning the title, going on to win without him, using the replacement pieces they did, kind of hurts how that Nash Dirk team gets looked a bit.
Yeah, definitely. So do we think, you know, there's always sort of the talk about how Phoenix, you know, definitely could or would or would have likely won a title with better luck, or, you know, was their defense always going to be a fatal flaw, plus, you know, of course, the tough competition they had with the Spurs, Mavs, and Lakers? Brian, do you want to go first?
I'd say this. They got unlucky that Robert Sarver isn't the owner he is now, that he was – they got unlucky that Robert Sarver isn't like he is now at the beginning when he first purchased the team, because now they value draft picks. They've built depth on the roster. He's willing to put money into it that he wasn't willing to do at the beginning, whether it be keeping Joe Johnson around, selling the draft picks, and he catches a lot of heat for that stuff, what he did at the beginning, and it's not necessarily a fair criticism anymore. And if he operated how he has the past 4 or 5 years, the Suns very well could have ended up winning a title.
All right. Well, then, you know, in his time in LA, do we think it could have worked with Nash, Howard, Kobe, and Gasol in LA, or was that always doomed to fail? Let's say Nash is healthy that whole year, the first year with Howard. Do we think that that was, there's any way that could have worked if it had been handled better, or was that always doomed to fail? Jordan, do you want to go first?
I think it would have been better. I don't think it would have worked as a lot of people thought it would. For one, Howard wasn't Dwight Howard that year. He still hadn't fully recovered from his back. You could see it in the way he moved. He got a little bit better as the season went on, especially towards the last month, month and a half of the season. But I mean, you know, he just wasn't who he used to be. And then you wouldn't have had good perimeter defense. Like, as like Nash's defense does get, I think it gets bashed a little bit more than it should. And Kobe isn't the defender that he used to be. And so those two together on the perimeter, that wouldn't have worked out well. I really would have liked to have seen it though. Like, obviously for a full season's worth, if nothing else, just for the passing. I mean, between he and Kobe and Gasol, there would have been some really nice passes, probably a lot of nice give and goes. But also, I just don't think it would have worked because Nash required a lot of maintenance. And the Lakers don't exactly have the best track record of keeping guys healthy. So it's almost kind of doomed before it started.
Any thoughts on that, Brian?
They won 48 games that first year. I think we kind of forget about that, that it wasn't as bad as it was made out to be, but they just didn't live up to the expectations of what was brought on to them when the group was put together. I don't think with once how we saw they were, I don't think they would have won an NBA title or anything like that. But I think they could have been a pretty solid basketball team that could have won 50 games if Nash would have had some better injury luck, and maybe Dwight took a little bit more time coming back and was healthier than rushing back to try and make everyone else happy.
Yeah, I just don't know if I'm sort of with Jordan in the same respect that I just don't know if it ever would have totally worked for a lot of different reasons. And I think a lot of them were non-basketball reasons as well. I just don't know if the attitudes in there were really going to work out. I just don't know if a Dwight Howard, Kobe Bryant relationship, even if they were winning and even if I just don't know if that was ever going to be, you know what I mean? I just don't know if Dwight Howard was ever going to be able to be okay and really fit in with that culture that Kobe sort of created and that the Lakers created. I just don't know. And Nash is the same way as well. I think, not to say that he's sort of a disruption in but it just, I just don't, the attitudes, there was just too much there to make it really work, in my opinion. But I mean, like Brian said, though, they weren't as awful as we like to kind of think. But yeah, I think come playoff time, something would have happened or it would have blown up, or I don't know. But I don't see it working.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if you got Phil Jackson in there, you kind of could have gotten everybody to buy in. But, you know, definitely finding the right place for Gasol to play was kind of getting Gasol and Howard to be able to kind of play together, you know, was a difficulty, particularly with Gasol declining a bit. And then just having Kobe and Nash play together, with Nash being so used to playing, you know, with the ball, and that adjustment, you know. So it seemed like, just with the talent there and the idea of it, just seemed like it so could have worked. And then, you know, yeah, and you're right, it wasn't exactly a disaster, but it was just such a, you know, it just fell so below what was expected. It just kind of feels like that. Mm-hmm. Anyone else have any thoughts on, you know, anyone, any more thoughts on Nash or anything related to his career?
I was upset. I wanted to just see, I talked about this when we did the Pacific Division preview podcast with Dubin. I just wanted to see a couple vintage Nash games this year. It was something I was really hoping to see. And in what otherwise could be just watching Kobe chuck up 40 shots a game, it would have been a nice storyline to follow with the Lakers as we're forced to watch them 18 million times on national.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bummer. It's always a bummer for somebody not to be able to go out on their own terms, especially someone, you know, who has great career as Nash and, you know, has brought so much joy. I mean, he really made the game more fun. Obviously the things that he did and the games that he had and getting, you know, his teammates involved, you know, like, whether he made them better or not, I think he made them more fun. He made his teams more fun and eventually kind of helped make the league more fun. And that's a pretty awesome legacy to have.
There are so many players who owe their contracts to Steve Nash, especially shooters.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, totally. Yeah. No, that, I think that's an important thing. Yeah. You know, Jason, you said that. I don't know if he necessarily made them better. I would make the argument. Yeah. I think he absolutely made a number of guys better just by, I mean, it could have been a little bit of the offense, but we've sort of seen even when D'Antoni was gone, there were still guys that were playing above. I mean, Nash, I think as a true point guard, and I don't know if there's a great way to quantify this. I don't know if anybody has done a decent amount of research on this, but I mean, just looking at him and what he could do to his team, I think, yeah, I'm a Jordan that I think a lot of guys should give a Steve Nash a nice little Christmas card because I think they owe a lot. I think Joe Johnson as well. I think he's absolutely one of them.
Tim Thomas had no business getting a contract.
That never happened. We're not going to talk about that. Tim Thomas contract did. No, it never happened.
Tim Thomas did seem like an awesome player that year. Like that seemed, I mean, you knew it wasn't real, but it felt like real, or it felt so magical that, you know, but yeah, definitely.
That three, he hit the game-winning three against the Clippers. I forget which game in the playoffs it was, but yeah, like Tim freaking Thomas did.
The best part about that too, I remember, it's because the Bulls kind of gave him away, and that was like a thing where Scott Skiles was just like, "Nah, I don't want this guy." And everybody was like, "Yeah, he sucks, whatever." And then you're just watching him just dominate the playoffs and just die, and you're just like, "Oh God!" Like this would have been really nice to have, but it was all a mirage, so it's okay. Yeah. We can all rest easy.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for joining us and having a little roundtable chat with about Steve Nash. Is there anything either you guys want to plug?
No, everything's just go to the podium game where you click to listen to this. All the stuff will be up there to watch, to listen to, not watch, and other stuff.
There's some watch. Yeah.
There is, I realized that as I tried.
All right, guys. Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
See you, Rich. See you, Jason. Thank you.
Nash hands it off to Stoudemire. They have that down so beautifully. Nash will penetrate, and Stoudemire will cut right off him. It's almost like a quarterback with a handoff to a running back. They run that play beautifully.
Stoudemire a screen. Shot pocket five. Hill a screen. Nash.
Oh, Stoudemire, what a pass!
Gets it inside.
That's why he's a two-time MVP.
All right, we're back, and Rich and I are going to kind of go through some of the highlights of Steve Nash's career. He grew up in Victoria, British Columbia in Canada. His father, John, played professional soccer in England and South Africa, and Steve was born there in 1974. So he's South African. Well, you know, he's Canadian, born in South Africa, and his parents were born in London. So he definitely has an international flavor for sure. And spent most of his life, of course, in the United States, or I guess most of his life now. Yeah, because he's been there since 18. So, and he's 41. So, or almost 41, I think. But anyway, he didn't really compete in organized basketball until the eighth grade. The only university to offer him a scholarship was Santa Clara, and the Santa Clara's coach, when recruiting him, had this quote of, "I'll offer you a full ride, but I've got to tell you that you're the worst defensive player I've ever seen." So, you know, he was impressive. He had the skills that he had today, obviously at a different level as far as passing, court vision, shooting, so forth. But I guess
it never got better.
The defense, you know, was there. And his college highlight was that Santa Clara upset number two Arizona in the first round of the NCAA tournament in 93 when Nash was a freshman, and he made six straight free throws in the final 31 seconds to ice that game away. The next season, Santa Clara was in the top 25 for the first time, and they beat Michigan State and UCLA and several other, you know, top programs. So he put them on the map. I think they made two other tournaments as well. So he obviously got some attention because of that, some national attention, even though they weren't on television very much. I guess unless they were playing large programs.
Arizona, yeah.
Right, but...
I watched that game, or I was watching highlights from that game, and it's pretty interesting that, you know, it's still his freshman year when that's going on, and even the announcers are mentioning, wow, this guy is pretty good. How did he slip through the cracks? And there's a big discussion going on about, look, you know, this... recruiting and college recruiting is such a big deal, and you know, you have scouts everywhere and everybody's watching every game and everything, and even then, I mean, this is still obviously, I think it's even more advanced now. I mean, obviously it is with the internet and just the ability to watch, you know, people can send you tapes or YouTube videos or all that sort of stuff, so really nobody's a mystery. But still, there's like a 10-minute conversation in this game about how the hell did this guy only get one offer? How did he slip through the cracks so much? Because they could tell even then, as that freshman year, what sort of a talent he had. And it's fun watching that because you can see, you know, he's not nearly as refined as obviously he'd become, but you can sort of see. I mean, it's Steve Nash. It's what you'd expect to see out of him. And it's just amazing that nobody else, you know, really wanted him or really. And even after that first year, it wasn't like there was a bunch of transfer offers that came to him or whatever. It was just kind of,
yeah,
he was just there, and it was just kind of Steve Nash. And you look at him and it's like, yeah, this is kind of just what he was always the rest of his life. And it worked.
Right.
I mean, it's just a good free throw shooter, a good shooter, and a good passer that, you know, was leading his team to success. It never changed.
Yeah. Apparently, there were offers for transferring after he was a sophomore, and he's like, well, I want to stay with my team like that.
Oh, okay. That's who did they say? Who?
I don't remember specifically, but you know, like he, you know, apparently the idea was thrown out there. I don't know if he seriously considered it or not, but it was definitely something, you know, people at least were
okay. Well, that's good at least.
Yeah, but
because that'd be ridiculous if you saw that and was just like, eh, I'll let him stay,
whatever. You know, so I didn't know this, but Kurt Rambis also went to Santa Clara.
Did he really? Yeah. Okay, I did not know that either.
Yeah, they are the only two NBA players to play Santa Clara, but that's pretty good, you know. Kurt Rambis obviously not as good as Steve Nash, but he, you know, he had some highlights as a player for sure. One thing, you know, just kind of that'll be a theme throughout, I think, or, you know, of a lot of the stories that I, you know, I read about Nash. I read probably about 30 stories, honestly, about Nash in preparation for this podcast. Humble brag. One thing is the importance of team, like what being a team actually means, like caring about his teammates or wanting to understand his teammates on a level beyond basketball. And caring about the team more than just like as a winning or losing thing. You know, I think some of those concepts are really important to him. And, you know, the fact that he wouldn't transfer from college, even though it could have been his advantage to do so, is, you know, I think an illustration of that.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit later, but I mean, reading the articles about when he's leaving Dallas, it's like the big, I mean, he doesn't want to do it. It's like a thing where, you know, it wasn't like, yeah, here's the money, cool, I'm out. It was just like, look, guys, like they're giving me this much money, I can't really like not take it. And you could tell there was sort of a, in all the quotes and all the stories, that there was just still a, no, you know, I don't want to leave. I want to, you know, do this with Dirk. You know, I want, and me and him are, you know, real good friends. Or it's just a genuine guy. And that's everything that you hear about him from people that covered him. And we talked, you know, Brian mentioned when he sort of had interactions with him. And everybody I've heard that's ever talked to the guy just said that just a very honest, down-to-earth guy, a guy that you really – just being in the room with for a little bit, you felt like you knew him on a personal level, and he wasn't and you hear that from friends too, and anybody that knew him, that people just really generally enjoyed, you know, his company, and he was just a good guy. So that's and you sort of see that early. You see that early, and you see it from the early stories, and it's one reason why I think we're on this podcast now talking about him, because he was a guy that was just so likable.
Yeah, and I think good guy is a better way to put it rather than nice guy, because I think like
– Yeah, no, he was brutally honest to some people I heard.
I think some people who are close to him and really like him say, well, you know, sometimes he could be kind of a dick, but they all still – you know, love him and think he's great. It's just, yeah, he does have that. There's that honesty and there's that directness and there's, you know, no BS as well. I think that's, kind of part of him, is, you know, for sure. So he was drafted 15th in the 96 draft. It's obviously one of the great drafts of all time with Iverson, Ray Allen, Kobe, Marcus Camby, Stephon Marbury, Antoine Walker, Peja Stojakovic, Jermaine O'Neal, Zydrunas Ilgauskas, and others. You know, a lot of guys who had, you know, long NBA careers. And apparently that pick was booed by fans who were assembled at America West Arena. They apparently booed Danny Ainge, who was the coach, or I guess he wasn't quite the coach of the team, but he was, you know, with the team. And then Don Nelson's son, who later became the the Dallas general manager, made the decision to pick him. He'd been a fan of his for quite a while. So
yeah, you read a lot about him, and he's actually a guy that I'd love to sort of, maybe in another podcast we talk about him, really responsible for a lot of the international players that came through Dallas and some guys that just generally came through the NBA. He was really kind of an underrated guy for, you know, being, that was sort of his job, was to be, you know, the international sort of scout in a way when he was kind of, you know, cutting his teeth for the Mavericks. And it's awesome to see the guys he was able to bring in.
Yeah, well, I mean, the fact that he was able to have the first Canadian superstar and first European superstar NBA players in one team is,
And don't forget about Wang Zizi.
No.
Wang Zhuzhu. I think it was Wang Zhuzhu. I don't remember how to do it, but yeah.
I don't remember that. I think he was slightly before my time. I remember him in a video game, but I don't remember seeing
him. He was ironically fun. Like, he wasn't good, but video games, he was awesome.
Yeah.
Like, he was an unstoppable force. And, like, I think it was NBA 2K3, I believe, I played with him. I could drop, like, 40 with him because he was just, like, so much taller than everybody. Like, him and Sean Bradley were just, like, an unbeatable team of, like, rebounding and dominance. But And real life imitated art in that sense, because they were obviously an unstoppable force that changed the game of the NBA for
us. Obviously, the player that I was trying to think of was it was Pavel something.
The big like 7 foot,
yeah, like 7'5".
Yeah, he was like 7'5", 7'6". Yeah, it was so – he just couldn't move
right
at all.
But
yeah, I remember they got him. I was like, ooh,
but he was
here
really
go.
Good in NBA 2K5 or NBA Live 05, I think. Whatever game – that was like one of the first – basketball video games like I got back into after I got into basketball, and he was like a guy who was like, he was a rookie and he was rated highly enough that you could kind of like have him as like, you know, a good contributor. Yeah. I think he could shoot threes too, so yeah. So
it was not very
it's always fun with the video game players and the and I wasn't quite sophisticated. I mean, obviously I knew there was a difference between a video game player and a real life player, but I wasn't like quite sophisticated enough to like understand how vast that difference was yet. So so it was interesting, like, why isn't he any good? I don't understand.
Yeah. It was amazing when I saw Gerald Green actually play basketball, and after my years of dominance in NBA 2K with him, it's because that guy, he could shoot threes and just dunk, you just jump over like five people at a time, and you're like, this guy's awesome. And
then
you're like,
oh, never mind.
He's not very good. Okay. No. Well, and now he's okay, but he's turned himself into an okay NBA.
Good. Yeah.
But it took about 8 years prior to his NBA 2K dominance to really actually be a good player. So.
Yeah, exactly. So
that'll be another podcast we'll do, is guys that are way better video game players than real life. So. That'll be my also shine in that one.
Yeah,
for
our
sure,
research so. Will need to play lots of video games, so that'll be tough. His rookie year of 96-97, he only played 648 minutes. They were a 40-42 team, but they actually started out 0-8. Cotton Fitzsimmons was coached for the 0-8 start, and they were coached by Danny Ainge. And he wasn't really going to get much time there because he played behind Kevin Johnson. And Jason Kidd was traded to the Suns that year. And Sam Cassell was also on the Suns that year, although I don't know if he really played because Cassell didn't play much either. He only played 539 minutes, although I think he might have been traded. Yeah, he was traded from Houston to Dallas. That was he part of the Jason Kidd trade?
Let me see. I don't think he was, but he was involved in something there. Let's see. Oh dear God, it's a giant. Here we go. Traded by the Suns with Finley and AC Green.
Okay, he was traded. That was 96. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Oh no. So he's traded from the Rockets for Chucky Brown, Mark Bryant, and Robert Horry to the Suns for Charles Barkley. Okay. So he was the Barkley.
Oh, and okay, and then he was. Yes, he was traded with.
Yeah.
Michael Finley, AC Green, for Jason. So he was in. He was
for
traded.
Yeah. So he was in that.
Okay.
One, yes,
he was. So.
And then traded by the Mavericks then for Sean Bradley and Ed O'Bannon, Robert Pack, and that whole then eventually got to the Nets, and then I never realized that he bounced around as much as he did in that early era, because I just kind of remember, like, I know the Rockets era, and then I know, like, the Timberwolves era, and then I know the rest of his career, but I always forget that he bounced around as much as he did.
Yeah. He played 5 years with the Bucks. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, right, the Bucks. Yeah, duh.
So wasn't getting much in that situation, but he did play he did improve in 96-98, played 1,600 minutes and had, you know, most of his numbers go up, you know, kind of finally got a role in which he could sort of prove himself and demonstrate that, you know, he was a pretty good player. I mean, but then basically Dallas was interested in him. On Donnie Nelson's recommendation, he was traded to the Mavs. He actually debuted at the same press conference as Dirk, who had just been drafted, of course, by the Bucks and then traded to Dallas. So,
which is one of the greatest NBA pictures of all time. Yes. Is Dirk in his, like, horrible comb over, like his mom, like, did his hair. There's, like, a perfect part in the middle, and it's, like, kind of bleached blonde but kind of black, and then Steve Nash has, like, you know, he had bleached blonde hair, and the brown was starting to grow in, but it was like this weird mop of, like, what the hell. You just got, like, a yucking up, like, Don Nelson in the middle of it.
He looked like a member of NSYNC.
Like, they had the frosted tips or whatever.
Yeah,
and that's when the Mavericks had their, like, old terrible, like, their weird logo with, like, the cowboy hat or whatever. It's just so ridiculous. It's just, like, unbelievable, especially when you see what they sort of became. And then it followed up was that picture with Mark Cuban and Nash and Dirk, where they're all wearing cowboy hats and, like, jumping on each other. It's just, like, unbridled happiness between, like, two young, like, it's just so weird.
Yeah, and they became fast friends, and, of course, you know, great pick and roll force eventually on the court. In 99, you know, both were kind of an initial disappointment, especially Nash. He was hurt, didn't play very much, and fans, you know, were booing him for missed shots every time he touched the ball. I mean, he shot 36% from the field and had a true shooting percentage of 0.471. So those are, of course, really bad numbers. But that was kind of when he started developing his serious back issues. And so, just, you know, I think injuries were pretty much the explanation for that. The second season in Dallas was definitely an improvement. He still had his struggles, but they, you know, at least were starting to show some progress. They were 40-42, which was, they didn't quite make the playoffs, but that was, like, the first decent record Dallas had in quite a long time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was, like, a revelation, because that's – I mean, this is a team that, you know, it's throughout the 90s was – they were winning 7 games, and, you know, like, just god awful off season. So 40 wins might as well have been, you know, let's a ticker tape parade worthy for them.
And over, like, the last 19 games of the season, he, like, was playing, because he only played 56 games that year, only 27 starts, but he started to play full minutes and started to kind of show, like, oh, okay, you know. And one of the things that you know, there's an SI story on it was written later as the Mavericks began to emerge, but one of them was just, like, he and Don Nelson clashed over the fact that Nash wanted to pass so much and was reluctant to shoot.
Yeah.
Which, you know, makes sense in a way, because, of course, Nash is such a great shooter, but maybe doesn't show quite the understanding of how special Nash would be as a passer as well, you know? I mean, I could...
Yeah, no.
Go ahead.
You read those quotes, yeah, and it's funny, because it's Nelson... I think he point blank says, look, I appreciate the passing, but I need at least 15 points per game from you. You know, I you're a good shooter. Use that ability. And it's sort of, you know, again, like we talked with Nash, he's so selfless. It was like, well, no, I want, like, everybody else to get involved. And it took Don Nelson being like, no, seriously, dude, like, I need you to score for me, because you're extremely talented at it. And as he got more comfortable in that role, you know, we saw the next progression of the Mavericks and the progression of Nash's career as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and finally in the 01 season, it was his first season playing over 2,000 minutes. They finished 53-29, beat the Jazz in the first round in 5 games, and fell to the Spurs in 5 in the second round. That was you know, not the title Spurs team, but a strong Spurs team. You know, obviously Tim Duncan Spurs. And one of, I guess that was the first of many times Steve Nash and Dirk would fall to the Spurs in the playoffs. That year, they were fourth in offensive rating, but near the bottom of the league in defensive rating, which would be a theme pretty much for the Mavericks. He played 70 games that year, and oddly, maybe this isn't that unique, but there were four players, Michael Finley, Dirk, Howard Eisley, and Sean Bradley, who all played 82 games that year for the Mavs.
So one of those names is not like the other.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's Sean Bradley playing 82 games is ridiculous. Yeah. That I can't fathom a situation where Sean, or why you would play Sean Bradley in every single game and not just give him like a few games off. But I guess maybe we know now why he was dust.
Didn't last too much longer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
But Donnie Ball, Donnie, don't question Don Nelson.
No, right? I wouldn't dare to question Don Nelson. He did play four more seasons after that. Mostly yeah. Full seasons. Yeah. We'll talk about that when we do our Sean Bradley podcast.
Right, yeah, the imminent Sean Bradley podcast.
And this is around the time that SI feature was written. There was also one that mentioned that Nash liked to date the celebs, Jerry Halliwell and of the Spice Girls, and Elizabeth Hurley, who apparently
those
hit.
Those are good finds. Those are
yeah. So
early 2000s. Those are the pretty peak early 2000s babes. I mean,
yeah, I guess the hair was working.
Clearly, yeah, here we are laughing at the frosted tips.
Yeah.
Well, he showed up. He sure showed us. He's got those – Got the British chicks. That's
right. Yeah. So, you know, it's a pretty similar story for the Mavs in the next season. They're first in offensive rating, 25th in defensive rating, 57 and 25. They fall in the second round again, this time to the Kings. And that was a year the Kings were really strong. That was, I think they were the number one seed that year.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, that is. Yeah, they're 61 and 21. Yeah, they were the first. Yeah, they were number one. So,
Nash plays 82 games and is an all-star for the first time. So, definitely moving on. I think that Dirk was an all-star for the first time that year as well. So it took, you know, an extra year of recognition for them to get there, but they definitely were that way. And then in 2002-03, that was the peak of that, you know, 4 year Mavs, Dirk Nash and Michael Finley run where they were really good. They finished 60-22. They were first in offensive rating, ninth in defensive rating. They had a tough road in the playoffs. They beat the Blazers and Kings, both took them to seven games. But they were able to win those series, and then they fell to the Spurs in six games. And this was the year the Spurs won the championship, their second championship. Yes. Nash was again an all-star. So, you know, ninth and D, they were definitely were at the you know, at a good point there where it was like, okay, well, maybe this is actually gonna kind of work, but. And they kind of made the bizarre move of adding Anton Jameson and Antoine Walker. You kind of get sort of the idea of just on paper that adds more talent, but that definitely where they they lost Nick Van Exel, who was kind of important to them off the bench. Mm-hmm. They lost Rafe LaFrance, who,
yeah,
you know,
good defensive guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Who got sort of an insane contract, but definitely like it was.
Oh, yeah.
kind of weird chemistry thing, I guess, you know. They obviously didn't have much defense because the next year they fell to 26th in the league.
Yeah.
And we're still first in offensive rating, despite John Schumann had an interesting stat where he talked about they had the number one offense that year, even with Antoine Walker shooting 27% from 3-point range, 305 attempts.
Yes, and then he said, I remember it well. Yes, he said
in fact, when you compare the team's offensive efficiency with the league average, that Mavs team had the number one offense of the last 37 years. Which was basically since 77, which was when turnovers were first tracked. So that's pretty impressive, despite having those flaws. But again, they took a step back and they lost in the first round in five games to the Kings.
What's funny, another sort of tidbit about that Antoine Walker year is you look at his total turnovers per game. So Steve Nash had 2.7 turnovers per game, and that's a theme of, I mean, obviously he's a point guard that's doing risky passes stuff. You sort of understand you're going to get turnovers because you get a bunch of assists out of there. Antoine Walker had 2.5 turnovers per game in that same year. Like, that, he had the amount of turnovers a point guard who's known for turnovers has. Like,
yeah,
just unbelievably Antoine Walker that entire year. Just so Antoine that year. Like, that was unglued Antoine Walker.
Yeah. And, oh, hey, 2004-05 Hawks legend Antoine Walker.
Oh, God. And one thing that's also fun to note is, and as you were kind of going through these seasons, I was sort of looking at you know, offensive rating, defensive rating, and then pace. One thing that's interesting to note is the year they got to the Western Conference Finals, they were ninth in pace. And every previous year, they were either in the top five. They were usually hovered around fourth. This particular year, where they went down to 26th in defensive rating, rather, they were second in the league in pace. So it almost seemed as the quicker they played, the worse they were at a lot of the facets of the game. But then this year, it just went overboard. It was just like, let's just score as much as humanly possible, run as quick as possible. Antoine Walker's going to shoot as quick as possible. And it imploded. It didn't work. And really, we're not a contender at any point during the year, really. I mean, they dropped to the Kings real quick and lost, you know, what was it, you know, 8 games off their record from last year. So,
yeah, definitely. You know, I would say, you know, we talked a little bit about it, of course, in the roundtable, but just the idea that, yeah, this, I do think, you know, that this is 4 years of, you know, 50 plus win teams that, and not really talked about that much. I mean, you know, obviously the rise of Nash and Dirk's friendship is talked about a little bit, and, you know, maybe a little bit of the what if, you know, Nash had stayed and what Dirk and Nash could achieve together, although obviously they achieved so much, you know, not together. You know, it enabled Nash to be in basically the perfect system for him and Dirk to emerge as a leader and for the Mavs to be able to fully build, you know, teams around him.
And that was reading through some of these articles too. There's quotes of guys, you know, I think Michael Finley in particular, that's saying that the big problem with those Mavericks team is they didn't have what they considered a leader. And it, you know, Finley wasn't saying that he was, and he said Nash really kind of wasn't, and Dirk, they kind of all looked to Dirk to sort of, you know, get to that level. And Dirk never really did when he had Nash, because he always sort of had, there was always the, you know, the three-headed monster, you know, when they brought in the other guys, it was the four, you know, four or five deep or whatever, but it wasn't at any point, and you watch those, and it really ever wasn't Dirk's team in a lot of ways. It was just sort of this collection of talent, whereas in later years, and especially when, you know, the Mavericks won their title, Dirk was like, okay, you know, this is, yeah, I get it, I'm the guy, I need to be the man, and obviously, you know, his stats backed it up and success backed it up. But it is very interesting, at that point it almost took Nash leaving for him to sort of go, okay, look, I need to be the guy here.
Yeah. And I think Nash kind of was a safety valve for him. And that also kind of reflects in their friendship, because, you know, Dirk didn't speak much English when he first was gone. He was kind of a nervous, shy person, you know, and Nash kind of took him under his wing and helped him sort of develop as a, you know, to a new place and a new job. And not that, you know, Nash was still pretty young and still figuring it out in some ways too, but at least he was comfortable in his own skin and, you know, comfortable with the league and in the world, where that seemed, you know, like a tougher adjustment for Dirk. So I can see that also being the same way on the basketball court as well.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah. So, you know, of course, you know, the big free agency in 2004, Nash wants to come back, but he gets the huge offer from Phoenix, and Phoenix and Dallas just, you know, at this point, Nash is, you know, older. I think he's 29 or so at this point. So, and has the health history, and, you know, they decide, no, we're not going to, you know, we're not going to match the contract. You know, it's just, it's too long, too many years for us, too much money. And it's funny, because it was like a, I think it was like a 6-year contract, where it began at $8.7 million and ended at $13.1 million. You know, I mean, just funny now, given, you know, the salaries that are in the NBA, just like, you know, I mean, it wasn't that long ago, and obviously just the structure was different, but, and, you know, honestly, the safe bet would be betting that Steve Nash would not be an awesome player at age, you know, 37, 38. But
right. And that's that, I think that's kind of interesting, is in doing the research for this and sort of looking back, you sort of forget that, you know, it probably shouldn't have worked out as well as it did. I mean, in most cases, signing a 29-year-old with chronic back issues that, you know, was playing in a system that was very quick paced, and it might have made him look better than he really was. I mean, I get the justification. I don't know. I don't remember reading, you know, articles or whatever that we're talking about. You know, this isn't, you know, they're nuts for signing him to this contract or whatever. But you can totally see how if it imploded and didn't really work well, where people would have said, well, duh. I mean, he's 29 years old, and the, you know, his back's, you know, if he had the issues he had with the Lakers or whatever, and it happened earlier. It seemed like in hindsight, we're sort of like, wow, I mean, that was an awesome deal for them. But I wonder what would have changed, you know, if he didn't have, you know, nearly as much success. But luckily, we don't have to do that because he had tremendous amount of success.
Yeah, and D'Antoni even says something along those same lines. I think it was like in an article in Phoenix Republic about, you know, that kind of like looking back on Nash's career, you know, when he left Phoenix, looking back in his time, it's, you know, it's like, you know, yeah, this could have blown up in our face. I mean, we thought he'd be good, and, you know, we didn't have any idea he'd be a two-time MVP, but, you know, just one of those things that could work out as well, basically, as it possibly could. I guess shy of an NBA Finals and a championship, mm-hmm. you know, it worked out as well as it could. So, we're just going to take a little break and come on back and talk about the rest of Steve Nash's career.
Yeah, tell me it's never ended, but now it's time to go. It's plain and simple because that game is like Guantanamo. So you either swim or sing. Lifeguard safe like a right guard. Sounds super soft when you write hard. I seem bashful, even though my glass flows straight to the point. Man, I got that Steve Nash flow. I said I listen, then right to watch the pain away. Front seat tripping out, feel like I'm in train today. You're like a rookie dog telling me to cook them all. Hit me with the show, I'll tell Evan to book them all.
All right, and we're back here now talking about the next step of Steve Nash's career, and obviously the step that I think most is most synonymous with his career and what we most sort of remember, and that's his, you know, run with the Phoenix Suns and a very famous team, the 7 seconds or less Phoenix Suns, coached by D'Antoni. You know, Nash is a multiple-time MVP. A big part of our roundtable at the top of the show. Jason, before we kind of get into the breakdown, what were your memories of this team? Because you talked about on last week's podcast, this was a big reason why you became a fan again of the NBA.
Well, you know, a game that I went to was the Hawks versus the Suns. It was actually day of the Super Bowl, so it was a Sunday afternoon game, mm-hmm. Early afternoon game, and I'd have to think it was probably the 07 season, because 06 Amari didn't play, and there was just a dunk duel between Josh Smith and Amare, and Josh got Amare, you know, like pretty good, like, you know, right in his face kind of dunk. And then like a few plays later, Amare just kind of came back and just totally stuffed it on Josh, and Josh went down and the crowd went nuts. 'Cause Atlanta, like, is usually, you know, as much of a road crowd as a home crowd. And I don't know exactly I think the Suns were more like appreciated by basketball nerds and big basketball fans rather than even casual fans, which is, even though they were so exciting, like, for instance, Nash was never like, my understanding is he was like never like a top 10 jersey sales, like even mm-hmm. during the peak of 7 seconds left, which seems kind of crazy to me, but even so, the Hawks were, you know, or Atlanta just, you know, I mean, it was just, I think maybe just because of the insanity of the play. I mean, there was plenty of times where the Hawks were cheered too, which is like one of those, like, oh my gosh, like fun things. Like, you know, it was fun to watch Nash. I don't really like remember anything specific he did in that game, but, you know, obviously it was just a treat to watch, you know, them work because they were so fun, even though I was rooting for the Hawks to win that game and was feeling kind of bad when Amari did that to Josh. But, that was before the jump shots just got too much for me with John.
Right, that was when he was still, everybody still liked him.
Yeah, exactly. that's kind of a weird thing in retrospect, but
yeah,
I don't know. I mean, there's just so many. I don't know. I mean, they had a lot of cool playoff series. I mean, they were just like we've said, the Thursday night TNT game. They were, you know, if you saw them play just about anybody, it was going to be fun.
Yeah, certainly. And you know, you mentioned going live to a show, and I remember a game rather, and I actually went to a game, and I said show there because it really almost was that way. And that's kind of what I was going to say, is I went to a Bulls Suns game around that time as well. And it was like half the crowd just couldn't help. I mean, it was it wasn't so much that they were just a likable team, but it was like they were putting on a show. Like you were watching, you were literally watching a video game there, and you couldn't help but cheer sometimes when there would be just that perfect Amari and Nash pick and roll, or like the perfect, you know, he'd put it between someone's legs, or he'd go behind the back. Like you couldn't help but just like cheer him on and watch. And you had to watch every move too. You couldn't leave at any point because something was going to, I mean, I remember that game that I was waiting in line for something. I was getting popcorn or something like that. And I was watching the TV and he just did like two straight plays that were just like, they weren't like super spectacular, but they were, you know, some weird behind the back thing or some one of his weird. I mean, every game was just filled with these weird passes. It was like, man, I just missed an opportunity to see that. And it became such a thing that when I would just watch him, it was just like, you had to watch every second because you just never knew when it was going to happen. It wasn't like his highlights were so subtle. They were so quick. They just kind of happened in the flow of the game that if you weren't paying attention, you'd miss them. And they might not have shown, you know, 15 different replays, especially if, as you mentioned, if you were sort of a basketball nerd, there was little stuff that might not have shown up in a replay and not been the most spectacular thing, but just little things that he would do to set up guys and set up open shots and you know, work the ball around and get defenders to look the other way. It was just remarkable what he was able to do with the ball.
Absolutely. So, 04-05, the Suns went from 29 wins to 62 wins for the third best turnaround in NBA history, at least at the time. It might have been beaten by the Celtics in the 07-08 Celtics, and maybe I don't know if anybody else has beaten that, but still very impressive. They averaged 55 wins over six seasons. The first year they were first in offensive rating, 17th in defensive rating, pretty much remained around those levels for the entire Suns tenure. I think the best they did was 13th in defensive rating. So, but they were always pretty much during the, years in which they were, you know, a playoff threat and, you know, at their best, they were always sort of more in the middle of the league. You know, the idea that they were a bad defense, I think has been debunked in most, you know, circles, at least of, you know, educated NBA fans, but, you know, like I said, they were more middling than bad. You know, combined with, you know, Sean Marion and Amari Stoudemire that year, they had Joe Johnson and Quentin Richardson and Leandro Barbosa, I think was a rookie or second year player. And of course, D'Antoni's coach, as you mentioned, that, you know, that was the original team. Those are really the, you know, major contributors that year. They weren't, you know, there weren't a, that was really a pretty thin team. Honestly, Barbosa and then Stephen Hunter were, you know, both around 1,000 minutes. Everyone else was around like between 2,500 and 3,000. Joe Johnson had 3,200 minutes that year. So,
yeah,
that was one thing about D'Antoni for pretty much the entire time, you know, that he was coached. They really, you know, he had very short rotations.
Yeah, and that's, I think that's one of the interesting parts about looking at that team and historically how people rank them. I mean, those teams really, I mean, there were good guys at the top, but I think more than anything, when you look at it, and I think the year that we're going to talk about in a little bit, where, you know, Amari is out and they just insert Boris Diaw and don't miss a beat and actually are a better team, you know, offensively and a better team defensively, just speaks to how, and D'Antoni's gotten a bad rap as of late and, you know, his most recent runs have obviously not been good, and people sort of, as you said, people, he doesn't play any defense and it's just a gimmick and all that stuff. But I think it really, really, people do a disservice to themselves if they don't really look back at these teams and look at what they were able to do, you know, with this talent, because there's not a ton of talent. I mean, Jake Voschkel is like a rotation player, and like Casey Jacobson, and you know, I mean, there's like these guys that are just, they're not good at all. Yeah. And like there's five or six guys that are good on that team, but that's it. I mean, it's not a very deep team.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking like, you know, Jim Jackson got 42 minutes in playoff games in for them after, you know, Joe Johnson went down with the, I'm trying to remember when that injury actually happened.
Yeah. When did that happen?
Did that happen in the Dallas series, or did that happen beforehand?
I don't recall. I know. Yeah, when did that happen? Let me look it up real quick so we can.
It happened in the Dallas series because he plays a full game one, and then game two, he plays as well
because he has the face mask.
He
at
only
some
plays 21 minutes in game two, and then I guess he's out after that, or maybe he played a little. It looks like he's out after that. I don't know if he came back at all later in the series, but or later in the playoffs. But I don't remember the specifics there. But yeah, I mean, they were, you know, they won that they won that Dallas series against a, you know, a really good Dallas team who I think won, you know, they won 58 games that year. You know, they were fourth in the league in offense and ninth in defense. You know, really bounced back, and the Suns were able to win in that second round playoff series. You know, basically with Steve Nash going crazy. I mean, one game they actually, the Suns actually lost. Nash scored 48 points, which I think is a career high for him. And he also had, you know, he had a game where he had 27 points, 17 assists. Game five, he had, he had 34 points, 13 rebounds, 12 assists. And in the closing game of the series, he had 39 points, 12 assists, 9 rebounds. So Marion had 38 points and 16 rebounds too. Obviously, you know, and Amari was there too. But yeah, I mean, that's pretty amazing that they were able to, you know, lose Joe Johnson and just have such a thin, you know.
And that's, I mean, and that's sort of a trend with a lot of these, that they would have these big injuries or they would lose guys. I mean, we're talking about in free agency, the guys they sort of lost, and how, you know, Brian mentioned that Sarver was just letting guys go. And it just even with all that, they still were just having unbelievable success. And it's crazy how successful these teams were under the circumstances and all that sort of stuff. And I just don't know if they ever get their credit, really.
Yeah. I mean, they just don't have that champ or even like a finals appearance, really, you know, which is, I think this is a pointing thing. I mean, if they just made a finals, I think that would have maybe changed, you know, what they were thought of, you know, a little bit. And, you know, probably 05 or 07 were kind of their best chance for that. I mean, 06, they were, you know, they just didn't have Amari for the, you know, the whole season. And
right.
Still won 54 games, but, you know, and we talked about that during the round table, but, going back to 05, yeah, they fell in the conference finals to the Spurs in five, then, but Nash did win his first MVP. And I thought this was neat. I think from one of Jack McCallum's stories, he got a congratulatory phone call from 1957 MVP Bob Cousy, and then also one from Kevin Garnett, who had won the year before, and Nash says, "You welcome me to the club," which, you know, which is fun.
I'd love to hear that. I'd love to hear that conversation between I can't imagine any scenario where Kevin Garnett and Steve Nash like talked to each other. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I don't know. Yeah, Kevin Garnett just has this, like, he just seems like such a scary guy. I mean, maybe he's
like he would just scream at him, and like Nash would just like kind of hang up.
I mean, Garnett's probably like nice to talk to, and probably
I'm sure.
Yeah, but he just
frightens me. Yeah, he frightens the hell out of me.
Yeah, so. You just can't separate him from his game persona, for like, you know, like a fair term. But, and then, you know, he won, of course, next year he wins the MVP again. They end up making the Western Conference Finals again, lose to Dallas in six games. You know, that was the year Dallas had another strong year that year. That wasn't the 67 win year, because of course they lost in the playoffs in the 67 win year, but and then in 07, Amari's back, and they win 61 games. They're first in offense and 13th in defense. And weirdly, they started 1-5 that year, but they had like a 15-game winning streak and a 17-game winning streak.
Yeah, I think from what I remember, and I could be completely wrong, and maybe some of that knows a little bit more, is that there was a little bit of like an awkwardness when Amari came back, and there was like questions of, oh, are they better without Amari? And then once he really got his footing under him, it was like, oh, never mind. Okay, never mind. They're pretty damn good. Like, because it was like they were trying to integrate him into the offense quickly, and it was like, I don't know. Like, it'd be better with just Dia, or, you know, it'd be better. And then, like, yeah, quickly then it was like, okay, never mind. Amari Stoudemire is very, very good. Yeah. And then that was a fun team as well. That's when they started getting a little bit deeper, in the sense that they had, you know, guys like a James Jones or a Rajah Bell and a few other guys that were good at threes. Kurt Thomas came in as a pretty good defender, and he was seen as a bit of a cog as well to sort of help their defense in some respects. But yeah, that I would say was probably their best team overall, and maybe not the most fun of their team, but definitely I think one of their better all around teams. That one, more than any, probably should have won it.
Yeah, well, I mean, they had just better depth. That, I mean, they went eight deep, you know, with pretty good players. You know, they had Diaw and Stoudemire in the front court. I mean, they were still undersized, but they just, you know, they had everything else, but they were able to, and Kurt Thomas, you know, they were able to kind of play their style. You know, they were a better defensive team. Yeah, that was weird, because that year was also the year that, as I mentioned, Dallas won 67 games, but they like started like 0-3 or something, you know? Like, that, weird that both those teams, probably I would imagine the two best records in the league that year had just such weird starts. Because also the year where, like, no, like almost nobody won 50-50 games out east.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, oh, God, yes. Yeah, I remember that. I'd love to read the newspaper headlines after, like, a week in, like, Phoenix and Dallas. Where they're like,
yeah,
fire this guy, trade this guy, Dirk sucks, like, Nash, like, just to see that. And they ended up both having, you know, incredible years. But
yeah, exactly.
Well, maybe less so Dallas.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly.
We don't want to talk about that.
No, that's a different podcast. That's our Avery Johnson podcast.
No, I will not be there for that one. I don't want to talk about Avery Johnson.
And they had a couple of really memorable regular season games. I mean, one of my favorite games I've ever watched was the 2-overtime game duel with Jason Kidd against New Jersey that was 161-157. I somehow thought it was a 3-overtime game, I guess, because of the score, but it was actually
the score would game. Indicate yeah. that it is indeed a 3-overtime game, but no, it was somehow, some way.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. Like 161 points in 2-overtime. That's.
Yeah, that has to rank pretty highly in the highest scoring games ever.
Yeah, oh, it's got it. Yeah, I don't have that in front of me. But
let's see. I'll look it up right now. This is always good for. Okay, it's fourth. And tied fourth. With 318. The record's 370 though. So, that Pistons Nuggets game. So,
Mikey Moore had 14.
Yeah, although
that might have been a career.
The other 318, the one that's tied with was not an overtime game. So,
Raul, is that one of those Nuggets? Yeah, freak shows 80, of the 80s.
That's an 84 yeah. Nuggets one.
Yeah.
The one that's slightly ahead of it, 320, is a 1990 Nuggets Warriors game. So,
Isn't it Nuggets Pistons? One of them.
That's the 370. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
83.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Spurs Bucks is number two at 337. That's the So yeah, those 80 Spurs and Nuggets, you know, have those. But yeah, that's just sort of an incredible random one. I mean, there's no other one anywhere, you know, anywhere near the 2000s. So.
What's fun about this game too, the double overtime game is Steve Nash has 13 assists, but he doesn't have the team high. Boris Diaw has 14.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah. There's just
that's great.
Yeah, I think he had 42 points in that game.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then Jason Kidd had a good game. He had 14 rebounds, 14 assists, and 38 points.
Yeah, so. And Nash hit a 3-pointer to tie in regulation too.
Yeah. Right.
So, and then there's another one that was kind of like. It was sort of billed as like deciding the MVP race between Dirk and Nash. Because honestly, Nash probably was better in 07 than he was in 06 or 05. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he's just, you know, I mean, that's you know, obviously a high standard. But they ended up, of course, giving Dirk the MVP. But then Dallas. The Suns came back from like a 15 plus fourth quarter deficit and ended up winning it 129-127 in overtime. And Dirk ended up being MVP anyway, but it's just kind of another like, you know, I mean, they had some real fun games that season and throughout their run, of course, but they ended up beating the Lakers in the first round with Nash having a pretty awesome game three in particular. And then they fell to the Spurs in six in the second round. This is, of course, the famous hip check from Robert Horry that sent Nash to the scorer's table and bloodied him up. And then Amari and Boris ended up having suspensions that cost they weren't allowed to play in game six, and the Spurs ended up winning that game. And this probably was the best chance for the Suns to make the finals, although they still had a long way to go, but they were going to destroy Utah in the final round.
Oh God.
Then probably, you know, against, they would have faced a weak Cavs team in 07, which they knew they would have destroyed as well. So yeah, if they had been able, of course they still had to win game six and Evan to win the series, but you know, certainly was conceivable. I think both was home games, so
yeah, it was. It felt like a demoralizing thing. It was kind of one of those turn the table things. I mean, obviously they still had their opportunities, but yeah, it hurt a lot. And I remember that was a big topic around NBA circles at that point, because that was still in sort of the midst of a lot of, you know, the NBA is rigged and blah blah blah. And like, I don't know, I don't believe that at all, but I believe that there was some issues with how that sort of everything went down.
Well, it's a dumb rule, obviously. Happened to step off the bench, and you know, I get, you know, getting involved. If they got involved in the fight, sure, but It's just like an unnecessarily strict rule, and it was just silly. But I don't think if the NBA was going to try to rig it, I do not think they would have rigged it for the Spurs.
I always bring that up when people are always like, oh, they rig it, and I'm like, it's usually in favor of the Spurs when you say that, or like other like slower, less exciting teams. So I really don't think.
Yeah.
Like I get it when people want to say, oh, they rigged it for like Los Angeles over Sacramento. Okay, whatever, because Los Angeles is a bigger media market. But there's nothing that's more appealing about San Antonio than Phoenix Suns in this year. I mean, the market isn't any different. It's ridiculous. It's yes, the exciting, fun team or the boring, you know, like, because and then people are like, oh, the Spurs are boring. I was like, well, yes, you're just like the same people are telling me the Spurs are boring. I'm like, well, then why would they? It's just, you know, people.
People are silly. I'm shaking my fist right now.
I did too. Yeah, I don't know if you saw it. Yeah, I don't know.
Yay.
I'm sure you saw me doing it, even though we're not on video, but right. You know.
I could hear it over the
speaker. Yeah.
We have good headsets. So
you're right.
So 2007, 2008, this was the year they traded for Shaq in the middle of the year after the Lakers had traded for Gasol. They finished 55-27, still good, but not quite as good. Shaq obviously kind of just changes the way they play because, you know, he is, even though he's older, still the focus, still in the middle and changing their spacing. They maintained a great offense despite, you know, losing Marion and having Shaq. But their pace slowed to fourth in the league, and that was with Shaq coming pretty late in the season. He only played 28 games for them. So I don't know if they may have been slow already. They also had added Grant Hill that year. Brian Skinner as well, you know, important. And it's always funny to be like the weird random guys. Like, oh yeah, he was on that team too.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You
don't remember the Brian Skinner Phoenix Suns?
I surprisingly do not, you know.
Oh, okay. Well,
yeah. And they ended up falling to the Spurs in the first round, 4-1. There was the famous Tim Duncan three-pointer in game one that, that was supposedly – I guess it was like I turned around the series even though like it was game one. I mean, it's a disappointment, kind of a turning point in the 7 seconds or less thing because especially with the next year, 08-09, D'Antoni leaves. They have Terry Porter as their coach, and just kind of sort of changes the way they try. They try to be like more of a traditional team, and they realize, you know, most of the way through this, you know, at 28-23, Terry Porter is fired, and they have Alvin Gentry come in for the rest of the season, and they go like immediately to back to kind of the 7 seconds or less thing, and Steve Nash is immediately more effective, and they miss the playoffs, but they're 46-36, so they're, you know, they're at least closer to, you know, I mean, 46 is going to get you in the playoffs most seasons, even out west. So they added Matt Barnes and Jason Richardson that year. Diaw only played 22 games, so that obviously hurt them as well. And I think he was kind of toward the end of his effectiveness. You know,
it was the beginning of Fat Diaw, yes.
Right, before he, you know, reinvented himself in San Antonio. But they had Robin Lopez as a rookie, but he didn't do much for them. So, and then they do get a bounce back year in 2010 season, 54-28. They make the Western Conference Finals against the Lakers. They actually sweep the Spurs in the second round. That's game four, is sort of the famous swollen eye shot game where, you know, he takes another hit to the Spurs and gets bloodied up and actually has a miss most of the third quarter. I think he got 14 stitches or something like that.
Yeah.
And then ends up coming in and taking over or playing well, maybe not taking over, but you know, making several shots in the fourth and basically sealing it with a three-pointer, you know, with one eye swollen shut. So that was a year where they added Channing Frye, Jared Dudley, and Goran Dragic, yep. You know, and, you know, even in they made the Lakers nervous in the Western Conference Finals, but then, of course, they have the Kobe air ball that Artest is the perfect place to rebound and it in and, you know, prevents it from going to a game seven. And then that's, you know, that is pretty much the end for the Suns as a relevant team. Nash is there for a couple more seasons, but they're not really, you know, they make a big trade with Orlando to, what did they end up getting?
Vince Carter.
Yeah, did they get Vince Carter and Turgaloo in that trade?
I believe.
Or were those separate trades? I'm trying to remember how.
I think they were separate. Because they both came. I mean, obviously they both came from Orlando. Let me see here real quick just to ensure. It was Gortat and Pietrus for Earl Clark, Jason Richards, and Hedo Turkoglu. So yeah, okay.
Okay, so they had Turkoglu first, yeah. And then they traded him for he was involved in the Carter trade. Orlando got him back. Okay, gotcha. That's right. So I mean, they had 19 guys play for them that year, which you know, you know, a lot of guys who played a decent number of minutes for them. So, including Xavien Dodwell.
Yeah, who, I don't know who that is.
Remember him, but he played 24 games and 12 minutes per game for them. So.
A little young Aaron Brooks on this team as well. Yeah, who is Xavien?
I don't remember him.
And I even remember Ghani Lowell, but I don't remember. Yeah, I don't remember Xavien Dodwell.
They signed Hakeem Ward. Well, they lost Amari, of course, after 2010, which of course the big loss. And they signed Hakeem Warwick and
yeah, that'll
and
make
Josh Childress. Josh Childress at the time seemed like a good signing, but
that was him coming back
from Greece.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but he was a huge bust for them, and they were a team clearly in transition. The next year, they were 33-33, basically the same story, just, you know, were kind of wasting Nash's year. I mean, they were still, like, they were not a terrible team. I mean, they were a decent team, but they were not, like, you know, a relevant team anymore, you know. Mm-hmm. Nash was doing his best to keep them afloat, but it just wasn't really working out so well. So they decide, okay, it's time to end the Nash era, and then we get the famous trade to L.A. It's hard to believe this in retrospect, but the Suns got 2 first and 2 second-round picks out of it, which is, you know, pretty amazing haul for – I mean, obviously Nash being a franchise player, but, you know, just how it turned out in L.A., didn't work out. And I thought Paul Flannery had a pretty good – at SB Nation had a pretty good summary of just, like – refer to him as a cover band version of the player that he was in Phoenix and Dallas. He could still shoot and could still pass, but he was part of an ensemble that never clicked or made much sense in the abstract. And, you know, we talked about this. I don't know if there's anything else we can add to this that we didn't talk about in the round table, but just, you know, obviously the issues with Dwight, the fit with Kobe, you know, fitting with Kobe, Mike Brown being the coach and trying to install that Princeton offense. I remember that Grantland series where Nash just says, like, you know, none of us do this offense, you know, and Brown was gung-ho about it. I know at first Kobe was gung-ho about the idea, but it's required so much running for old players and Dwight, who's hurt, you know, that it just obviously didn't work. And he, you know, Nash hurt himself in the second season of the game, I think, bumping into Damian Lillard, and got a fracture in his leg, and it just, you know, caused his body to, you know, finally, he just not be able to play anymore. And he came back and played 50 games and was still effective, but, you know, it just, you know, once Kobe was injured late in the season, they made it to the playoffs, but, you know, they had no chance of doing anything.
Yeah, I was looking real quick at those draft picks that you were talking about, the big haul of draft picks they got. One of them is still sort of floating out there that might actually be a pretty important one in the future. It's a 2015 first rounder. It's protected selections 1 through 5 in 2015, 1 through 3 in 2016, 1 through 3 in 2017. Then becomes completely unprotected 2018. So that'll be interesting to follow as the Lakers are not going to be very good for the next few years.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to have to be good. I mean, you know, because they, I mean, they might be good enough to, or they might be, you know, they, I guess they'd be bad enough top five. I mean, they definitely could be a top five, you know, this year. So, I mean, yeah. But I don't,
number six
I don't
overall
think
pick.
They're
free,
not going to be good this year,
pick,
and I don't think they're going to be good next year. So,
no. So,
you know, yeah, that'll be interesting. But
yeah, it'll be fun to see.
Yeah.
That pick might pay big dividends later.
And then obviously his last season, he only played 15 games, basically struggled, you know, had a couple of moments where he kind of looked like his old self, and the Lakers were, you know, pretty much a disaster. Kobe didn't play for hardly any of the season. And, you know, the most famous thing he did that season was the Grantland video series documenting, you know, how hard he was working in his comeback and, you know, just sort of the struggles that he was having of wanting to still play and contribute and feeling like a, you know, basically like he was just a contract.
Right. Yeah, you could see the fun was kind of, and especially the way he played too, the fun of it was sort of gone for him in a lot of ways. He just looked miserable playing. It's just, and you could tell he still was trying at some point, but it's just, it wasn't the old, and it's almost symbolic too, because, you know, he cuts his hair, and it's just like, it's such a weird sort of national Lakers uniform. It's just like, it's icky and weird, and it doesn't really ever fit. Like you said, the cover band version, like, I think that's a perfect way to put it, because it's just, I like to think of it as not the same Steve Nash, because it's just so, it's so disheartening, because it's just, yeah. It's just weird. I don't like it. I just hate that era of Steve Nash. Not for any reason of him. It's just everything. It's just a terrible way to end it now, especially now what we know and him being hurt this year. And you just really wish he had, you know, another better run, you know, with another team maybe. But, yeah.
Absolutely.
Alas.
Well, I know you have some, you know, some of the numbers that stand out for Nash. Do you kind of want to go through some of the some of those highlights?
Yeah, let's run through a few here. Number three on the all-time assist list, and I'll get to some play index ones to sort of show that as well. But I mean, that's significant. Number three on the all-time assist list. You can make a real case as one of the best free throw shooters ever. I think from a percentage wise, I think he might be second or like tied for second all time or some ridiculous. I mean, he's at 90.4. I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous. And in terms of guys that took a lot of free throw shots, I mean, he is far and away of the guys that had over 1,000 free throws. I mean, he's light years ahead of anybody, even Rick Barry. I know Rick Barry won't probably want to admit that, but he is indeed higher than Rick Barry. Not by much. That's by percentages, but you know, Rick Barry will probably come up with something for that. Through 18 seasons, he shot 49% from the field, 42.8% from deep, and then 90.4%, as I mentioned, from the free throw line. Career true shooting percentage of 0.605. So just an unbelievably, you know, and Brian mentioned that in our roundtable as well, a guy that doesn't get credit. We sort of talk about his passing and his control and all that sort of stuff, but the guy was just an unbelievable shooter and just a super efficient shooter from a ton of different places on the floor as well. We had a Hal Brown article that's out right now on the Nylon Calculus that's really good, that shows sort of his shot charts. And it's they're not from efficient places on the court. You would not – it's not just threes and layups. There's a lot of mid-range jumpers, a lot of weird – he was really good at those sort of like weird like jumpers from the block that were like fadeaways. And it didn't make any sense that a 6'3 guy was taking like a fadeaway from that close to the basket and having it still go in and still be a good shot. But, yeah, he great at those. A few other things here. He's one of seven players in NBA history to win consecutive MVPs. As we know, he's one of six players to shoot 50% from the floor, 40% from three, and 90% from the line in a single season. And he's the only ever player to do it for four seasons as well. So that's very significant as well. Missed only 41 games total over an 11-year span, which is just awesome. And what's so you know, annoying then about how his career ended is he was just such a reliable guy for so long, and now it's just sort of ending this way. Nine straight seasons of running the number one offense in the league. A few other things here. He's one of four players ever to have over 17,000 points and 10,000 assists. So it's a combined sort of points and assists. The only other three are Magic Johnson, Jason Kidd, and John Stockton. So that's good company to keep for sure. He's only one of five people with over 10,000 assists, rather. Mark Jackson, Jason Kidd, Magic, Stockton are the others. So just Mark Jackson jumps in there. And then 61 all-time seasons in NBA history that had over 800 assists. Steve Nash comes in third. Stockton had 10 of them. Magic had nine. Nash had was third with six. Just to put it in context, well, Oscar Robertson only had five of those. So definitely an incredible just career overall. A few more things here real quick. Second lowest turnover percentage amongst guys with an assist percentage over 40%. Only Magic Johnson was better at having, you know, less turnovers and more assist percentage. So just an amazing company to keep for Steve Nash. I mean, really, you know, we don't even have to have a conversation about a Hall of Fame. I think he's a no-brainer. And I think, you know, I won't call him the best point guard of all time. I don't think he's quite there, because there's still, you know, the guys we mentioned, the Stockton's, the Magic, you know, even a Jason Kidd has a right. But as far as a guy from that era, I mean, just an unbelievable talent from the era. Just an all-time great NBA player.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously, I mean, I think the big deficiency for him was defense.
Yeah.
That's kind of what maybe keeps him from being in the conversation with Stockton or Magic or, you know, Oscar Robertson, you know, perhaps. But I mean, he's right. He's very close to that level, I think, but not quite there because of the defense. But yeah, I mean, I think the defense for him was more of just like like the effort was there and like the positioning was there. And it was, I don't think he was necessarily like a terrible defender. He was just overmatched on that end of the floor. Mm-hmm. And there may have been also some where, you know, you're, cause he has to do so much on offense. You're doing less on defense, you know, maybe some of that, but I don't see like, you know, I never felt like, oh, he's loafing on defense or he's not doing anything. It's more just like, okay, you know, because he lacks, you know, I mean, he was athletic in certain ways, but he did lack, you know, length. He wasn't a shrimp as a point guard, but he wasn't a tall point guard. He was elusive, but not particularly quick, and he couldn't jump. So, you know, relative to an NBA player, of course. So, you know, there is that, but I do feel like maybe his defense, like I think, you know, we mentioned in the discussion, maybe his defense, it's certainly a negative, but I don't think it's like this huge negative that puts him like that means like he's not as great as people think he is. Cause I think,
yeah. And that helped. Ron.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that Hal Brown article did a good job as well of breaking it down that, okay, look here, let's take all of his value for his defense and really put it over. Still, it didn't matter. Even with, quote unquote, bad defense, his overall value was still, you know, top five in the league. So
absolutely.
So yeah, there, I mean, any sort of deficiency on defense, he more than made up with just incredible offense and incredible sort of control of the team and control of his team's offense as well. So yeah, I mean, that they're not everybody can be LeBron James or, you know, Michael Jordan or these, you know, unbelievable, you know, these guys are mortals. Some guys are just going to have something they're just not great at. And that was defense was his, but it didn't matter. I mean, it didn't drive him down enough. I think that we should really, I think it gets muddied up a little too much. And that's the D'Antoni thing too. I think it's lazy where people just consider those teams that didn't play defense because they gave up a lot of points, which ignores the fact that they were also, you know, the possessions were way more in that game as well. So it's just not fair in a lot of ways, but yeah, I don't think it was enough to make him not an all-time great.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, is anything else come to mind when it comes to Steve Nash, or should we wrap it up for our listeners?
No, I mean, there's not much. I think we've done a good job. I think the roundtable is a good discussion as well about him. I think he's just the guy that I'll reiterate from, you know, the previous podcast. He's just the guy that, for me, in a lot of ways, made the NBA fun again and made me a better fan. And you know, I mentioned that it was Dirk and that Mavericks team that really turned me into a super fan, but I think that Dirk wouldn't have happened really as well as it did without a Steve Nash. So I always sort of attribute him as well. And Dirk is, you know, my favorite NBA player of all time and a guy that, you know, I'm making plans now to go see him in Chicago again. And every time he comes to Chicago, I try to go see him and there's a bunch of stuff. And, you know, I met him multiple times and that sort of stuff. And I think a lot of that, I have to give credit to Steve Nash for sort of getting Dirk comfortable, getting him acclimated and just overall just making basketball fun for me and making it just so many memories of watching him. You know, we were watching videos in anticipation and research of this and sort of watching those old clips of him just operating an offense. It was just like, ah, yes. Like, that's just what I remember from my youth. And you never really get that back a lot of ways where, you know, now I'm a jaded fan and I do this, you know, regularly or, you know, I'll write or do all that. So I look at the game differently. But yeah, he was one of the last few guys where I was just a true fan, you know, of what he did. So yeah. Just really enjoyed Steve Nash overall.
Cool. Well, all right. Well, thanks, everyone, for checking us out. Of course, we're at thepodiumgame.com, which is part of the Hardwood Paroxysm Basketball Network. You can subscribe to the Hardwood Paroxysm feed on iTunes, which we are a part of, along with several other great podcasts, including by our guests before. And you can find us on Twitter at OverAndBackNBA. We're also at Over and Back NBA on Facebook, and overandbacknba.tumblr.com is a website where you can find links to our shows and other things, as well, a few other things as well. So thanks so much for listening. We greatly appreciate it. My voice is about to go, so I am going to say goodbye, but come back and I'm
you're done.
All right.
you're,
there we go.
Drink your orange juice.
Goodbye, everyone.
I love you. I come home every night and I hug you.